Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
And I'm delighted to be here, Matt Matem.
Thank you for joining us. So we've got some exciting guests dropping by this week. We've got Dan Stevens, who's here to talk about his new horror film, Abigail. And we're also going to be hearing from the team behind Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver. That's director Zack Snyder and stars Sophia Boutella and Staz Nair. And we're also going to be reviewing those films, as well as The Book of Clarence and Sometimes I Think About Dying. But first, before we dive into all that, Jamie, have you been watching anything this week other than those things we're going to be talking about?
I've kind of done a twofold watch. So on the film side, I've been revisiting some Orson Welles movies because I found an old documentary, an arena documentary on BBC iPlayer on Orson Welles, which I'd never seen before, which is really good. A two-part documentary about 3 hours long, going through all his career from, like, you know, the stage shows and the radio play of War of the Worlds to kind of going to Hollywood, Citizen Kane, and right through his career, the ups and downs. So that kind of sparked off my interest again. It's been a few years since I watched some Orson Welles. So I've gone back and started reworking my way through his films, which I'm having a whale of a time doing. And then on the TV front, I kind of binged Ripley, the new Stephen Zalian version of the Patricia Highsmith novel. And absolutely adored it. I've done all 8 episodes. I mean, it's an acquired taste, and it's very kind of almost art house. It's black and white. It's slow moving. It's very deliberate. It's one of those things where everything plays out meticulously, you know, with no fast cutting. If someone walks to the end of a road, you watch them walk to the end of a road. There's a couple of scenes, you know, with big murders in it, and the murder happens, and then you kind of spend the time with them while he's trying to worry about how to clear up the body and get rid of the evidence. And, you know, it would take a whole episode on that, of him kind of going back and forth and mopping up blood and doing various things. So it's very kind of slow burn. So like I say, it probably won't be for everyone, but I found it completely immersive and intoxicating. And just that world sort of set in the most beautiful scenery of Italy and the time and place was so perfectly realized that I absolutely adored it. It's probably my TV show of the year so far.
I actually do really want to see it, but I was really put off, as you know, by the clip they showed on Gogglebox, which I just don't know why they allow some of these things to be shown on Gogglebox, because out of context, it just looked so silly and almost comically bad. So I need to let that sort of recede from my memory first, and then I'll dive into this miniseries, because I do love Andrew Scott, so I'm intrigued.
Andrew Scott's great in it. He plays Ripley as a lot more kind of reptilian in a way than Matt Damon did. Matt Damon was a bit more sort of warm and needy and likable in a strange way. Whereas Andrew Scott, you see the neediness, but it's darker. You know, you can really see the hunger in his eyes. So he's very, very good in it. But it is weird about Gogglebox, why they do that. I think whenever you see a clip of a movie or TV show out of context, it always looks a bit dodgy. I used to think that when I was a kid watching Barry Norman, you'd have this film that had been raved about and they'd suddenly cut to a scene, you know, a 2-minute scene, and it would look really ropey. And then you see the film in the cinema a month later and the scene is absolutely brilliant in the context of a film. It's quite bizarre.
And it's like, if you ever stroll in and someone else in your house is watching something, just to watch that one scene out of context, it just always looks bad, doesn't it?
Usually, yeah. It's a strange phenomenon.
But yes. So, yeah, mainly been TV that I've watched. I, as sort of long-term listeners will know, of course, I watched the extended Bluey episode, The Sign, which was out on Sunday. I was kind of crazily, crazily hyped for it. And obviously, there was all this kind of talk of it leading to potentially something big. Potentially, is this going to be the last ever episode? All that kind of stuff whirling through my mind. So I went into it with such kind of heightened emotions. And I really enjoyed it. And like all the kind of best Bluey episodes, I sort of thought it was funny and relatable and moving. But I need to view it again without any kids present, for one thing, so I could just, you know, have zero distractions. But I kind of found the ending a tiny bit sort of verged on the cop-out for me. I was hoping for just something a bit bigger. But, I mean, that said, I do just adore Bluey. So just to be able to luxuriate in that world for a bit longer was enjoyable. Like, even though the 28 minutes absolutely flew by,
I was going to say this whole Bluey phenomenon has passed me by. Well, I don't have children, maybe that's it, but I've never watched an episode of Bluey, and everyone I know who watches it with their kids absolutely adore it and rave about it. I mean, is it something I should be watching?
I think so, yeah. It's definitely the absolute like parents' favorite of all the children's TV shows, because there's some that are like less offensive than others, less irritating, and you kind of appreciate what they're doing. But just in terms of pure enjoyment of watching, it's kind of like, I mean, it's not at all like The Simpsons really, but it sort of does remind me of The Simpsons in a little way, in that I love this kind of the world they've got, and just there's loads of other kind of great supporting characters in it as well. And obviously there's something of the family dynamic of that always kind of, it's impossible not to think of The Simpsons a bit these days. But because they're sort of 7, 8 minutes, the episodes, they're just so easy to watch, but then they really cram a lot in, you know, like, and so many of them are sort of tear jerking, and then a lot of them are just very funny, and there's a lot of kind of humor that is just clearly geared towards the adults. So it's just, yeah, it's great. I reckon it's a weird one, because obviously, I mean, I imagine virtually everyone's got into it via watching it with children. But I mean, I have heard of some people that say they don't have children, but they just love watching it. It's just, yeah, it's very, very enjoyable, very, very easy to watch.
I'll give it a
Yeah.
go. I went back and watched Mr. Ben recently, which it's on one of the streaming platforms. I can't remember which, but I just happened upon it, and I remember it from a kid that I absolutely loved it. And I was really surprised that there's only about 10 or 12 episodes. And I just remember watching it as a kid week after week. I must have watched the same episodes again and again. You know, I thought there'd be seasons of
Yeah.
it, but there's just about sort of 10 or 12. And they're all quite short. So I watched them all like in a couple of evenings. Loved
Yeah.
it. It was so
I
nostalgic.
mean, Bluey, there's like 150. It doesn't feel like there's been that many, but there's like 150 episodes of Bluey, because there's like three seasons that are all like around the 50 episode mark. So there's a lot to get in there. But like I say, they're just so easy to watch, because they're, yeah, 7 or 8 minutes. That's what we've been watching anyway. On to this week's films now. First up, it's the new horror from Radio Silence.
You're really good at pretending to be a little girl.
Thank you.
Quick question. Who's inside a cage right now?
What do we know about vampires? How do we kill it?
Crucifixes.
Stake through the heart.
Daylight is a big one.
We need to find a way out of here.
We split up.
So this is Abigail, which is the new film from the sort of horror collective Radio Silence, who sort of made the recent Scream films. And it's a tricky one, because what I'll say is I won't say too much about the film now, because if you haven't seen any trailers by this point, I really do think it's a film that would benefit you going in cold. But if you have seen the trailers, or you're not so fussed about kind of, you know, mild premise-based spoilers, then I'll say a little bit more, which is that this film is mostly set in one location, and it follows this group of sort of hired criminals, basically, sort of hired mercenaries, who have been kind of brought onto this job to basically kidnap this young girl who is a daughter of someone very powerful in the kind of crime world. They kind of take her to this remote sort of safe house where they've got to just wait out the night, basically. From then on, some weird things start happening. So we'll go into it a bit more in the review section, so you can kind of skip that again if you feel so inclined to go in cold and sort of enjoy it, you know, as fresh as possible. But before me and Jamie actually review this film, one of the film stars, Dan Stevens, who plays Frank. They're all given kind of Rat Pack related code names, but he plays Frank. He's one of the criminals kind of presiding over this kidnapped girl. And here's what he had to say when he recently sat down with our online entertainment writer, Amy West.
This is just a game to her.
What can I say? I like playing with Liza.
Hello?
With Abigail and Godzilla Kong and Cuckoo coming out, I keep seeing people on Twitter being like, Dan Stevens is in his weird era and I'm here for it. But does it feel that way to you? Because I feel like you haven't really ever done the same thing twice. So you kind of always been in your weird era, right?
I've always been in my weird era. I think that's fair to say. Yeah. I mean, that's lovely that people are sort of noticing that I am in my weird era, but I hope they're not expecting me to leave it. You know, because yeah, they'll be disappointed.
Although I was going to say you haven't, well, yeah, I said you haven't really done the same thing twice, but you have done a vampire movie before.
That's true. Although that was technically a vampire romantic comedy, this is quite different. It's tricky to know how to describe Abigail because I sort of keep saying it's a, in my mind, it's more of a comedy. It's a horror comedy. Not everybody knows what that means necessarily. But I think if you're familiar with Radio Silence and those guys who, you know, did Ready or Not and Last Two Screams, and that tone is something that I've always really enjoyed, that sort of horror comedy where the gore just gets sort of taken to such an extreme that it just starts to become hilarious, and just some great one-liners thrown in while people are going through all sorts. You know, I enjoy that.
I think that's the thing, right? Because I'm a horror nut as well. And I think when you are into the genre already, you kind of just see the comedy in these types of things. Like, I was really struck by how laugh out loud funny it was. But then yeah, I mean, you're not totally used to it. You're like, whoa, there's loads of blush.
I guess it's my sort of like fear reaction is laughter. Like I've always laughed at scary things. Like I think, you know, some on some unconscious level, I'm sort of trying to cancel out the horror with laughter. But, you know, if something really, really extreme happens in a horror film, I just laugh out loud anyway. But then to sort of be allowed to play with the dialogue and play with the character that is in a way that, you know, you get those zingers in there, you get those one-liners, you get, you know, just funny back and forth between characters who you know, are having a bad day, they don't like each other, you know, or whatever, in the middle of something completely insane happening. That always delights me.
And I mean, the one-liners are great, but also the visuals are just, they just crack me up. Like, I was laughing about Catherine holding the garlic for like an hour after I saw it.
Yeah. Her character is very, very funny. And she does a great job. I really loved working with her. And I really enjoyed her in Lisa Frankenstein as well. I mean, she's been around and she's been doing stuff for a while, but I think she's really becoming a great sort of very, very funny sort of lead actress.
It's awesome. I was going to say, I love kind of how meta Abigail is. It's kind of like, I mean, it's appropriate, but it's kind of like the vampire version of Scream, because these characters are dealing with these monsters with stuff they know from pop culture, not that it really helps them that much in this instance. What was that like to sort of play with that lore?
You know, that's one of the fun things about it, really, is that with sort of horror filmmakers, but also, you know, specifically with vampire filmmakers, it's like you're entering into a canon. So it's like, how are you going to do this time? You know, and sometimes that will be outside of, you know, an awareness of popular culture. Ours is very much like, oh, okay, is this Twilight? Is this True Blood? Like, are we talking Anne Rice here? Like, what, you know, what kind of vampire is it? And I think that is part of the fun, is like, well, what nature of vampire are we dealing with? How are we going to defeat them? What happens when you turn? You know, these are all questions that any filmmaker has to sort of face when they're making a vampire movie. Is like, well, what's going to be different about this one? And that's part of the fun of sort of entering into the genre, really. It's like, okay, well, what's the spin going to be? But to sort of wear that on our sleeve a bit and just be like, okay, you think you've seen vampire movies, but you've never seen a vampire ballerina heist movie.
I won't go into specifics, but obviously they try a few things out on Abigail and it doesn't really work. It's like when you watch a possession film, right? And the possessed person starts reading scripture or something. There's that shock value where you're like, Jesus, what are they going to do?
You know, Radio Silence, Matt and Tyler, they had a lot of fun making this, you could tell. And we all did, you know, and I think they were really sort of excited to get to play with that element that you're talking about, you know, that, yeah, all bets are off and we just, you know, we can go absolutely nuts.
I know you say they were really keen to sort of do something different, but did they ever say on set any influences, either vampire movies or heist movies that you could kind of look to as inspiration?
I don't know if there were any like specific ones. You know, often the sort of references were quite, you know, they could come from action movies or anything really. Just sort of, you know, I think there are a lot of influences mixed in there, not just sort of vampire and heist. You know, we kept joking that my character's look very much came from Tim Robinson's I Think You Should Leave. And so we were just kept referencing that sketch. And we're all just big, big fans of Tim Robinson. So, you know, yeah, exactly. Slick back hair, sloppy steaks. So, we had a lot of fun with that. With guys like that, and especially with the sort of genre guys, they've seen so much of cinema. You know, they're just so steeped in it that, you know, references can really come from anywhere. And I love that, you know, especially when they send you off and just, you know, you're watching a movie that you would never otherwise have seen. And it's just because it's come up in conversation.
It really is so bloody. I feel like I heard a lot of people saying that beforehand. And I was kind of like, I mean, how bloody is it really going to be? And it really is. And I saw a behind the scenes featurette where a lot of it was done practically. And I was wondering how that kind of affected shooting. Did you have to shoot pretty chronologically because of the carnage? Because like the cleanup would take ages.
That's right. Yeah, the cleanup was epic. And generally, if we were going to destroy a set, well, I say destroy, but, you know, completely cover a set in blood or whatever, it would have to be, quite chronological. I mean, all of us increasingly, as the movie goes on, we change color, basically. We're just like completely caked in this stuff by the end of the movie. Matt was telling us the other day that we basically drained Ireland of their movie blood supply, and we had to get stuff shipped in, especially because we had used all of the reserves in Ireland. It's just like, it's basically like corn syrup with a special kind of coloring in it. And so you're just like covered in this stuff, and it's so sticky. And after a day of that, it was really, really gross. And very rewarding showers taken at the end of each day.
What was the craziest day on set, if you could pinpoint a specific moment where you looked around and you were like, what are these madmen making?
I guess without giving too many spoilers away, there is one, I'll just call it an explosion of blood. I won't get too specific, but as the movie goes on, these explosions get bigger and bigger and bigger. There is one particular one that was so epic. Pretty much the entire crew kind of gathered around, and they sort of clear the set because it's so big. But we're all kind of like stood just off set watching the monitors. And as you were saying, you know, because it was sort of chronological, there was no going back from this moment. You know, the set after this point was that, you know, forever. So there's a lot riding on it, you know, in terms of like, can we get this in this one take? And they were doing various tests of these cannons in the car park outside, which people would also gather around to watch. So they were just sort of like blowing, you know, these huge things going off in the car park. And any day like that on a set where there's like a real event, special event happening with special effects, and the fact that it was so practical and so visual, just is really, really fun. And yeah, I think that was probably the maddest day.
Going to that kind of thing, like it's cannon day today. Like...
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's such a great ensemble across the board, but I really loved you and Melissa sort of going toe to toe. I've interviewed her before and she was very like warm and friendly. So what was it like being an absolute dick to her?
I mean, Frank is just a dick to everyone. He's just he's the worst human. But yeah, it was fun. Melissa is so sweet and bright and funny. And so we just had a great time. I would very often try and make her laugh by just sort of coming up with things. There was one day where I think in the end they went with something like Angelina Ballerina or something, but I refer to Abigail upstairs. Basically every take I was coming up with a different way of referring to this thing. So she ended up making a t-shirt for the crew which had all of the different alts that I came up with, but there was like Amelia Bedelia and Billy Elliot and any ballet reference I could think of, I was just like throwing out there completely. She was completely unprepared for it, and so there was a lot of that, just like trying to make each other laugh, really.
And what was it like working with Alicia as well, because she's like, she blew me away in this. It's so good,
all of us.
She's like unbelievable as well.
So funny, so smart, sweet as you like, just like big smile on her face, you know, with covered in blood, just like having such a great time. She's so professional. She's a gymnast, she's a dancer, you know, just absolutely incredible. And I had seen her in Matilda and thought she was British. And then I hadn't met her before we did the read through, and she just came in, sat down, and we started doing the read through in this room at the studios. And she did this flawless American accent. I was like, oh, so she must be American. She was doing a British accent in Matilda. And then I met her afterwards and she's like, no, I'm from Dublin. I just, you know, I was like, do you have a dialect coach or anything? And she was like, no, I just watch the telly, you know, and she's just like the loveliest.
Makes it seem so easy.
Yeah, completely brilliant. And she's an absolute superstar.
And what are Matt and Tyler like to work with as well? Because you sort of, you sometimes hear, like, excuse the pun, horror stories from actors on horror movies where they've been sort of pushed to their limits by directors to get a performance. But these guys, it seems like their emphasis is really on, if everybody's having a good time, it's going to show.
Yeah, yeah. Their movies are fun. You know, they're there to make audiences laugh and scream in pretty much equal measure, you know, and I really like that tone. The way they go about that is exactly like you say. They're very sweet, they're very funny, you know, they want to make sure everyone is comfortable-ish, although I was cursing them by the end. It is covered in this sort of corn syrup every day, but No, generally speaking, I mean, there's very, very, you know, funny guys. And, you know, I love anyone who can work with a sense of humor, no matter what the scene is, you know, that we work with a sense of humor and that everyone is sort of enjoying being at work. You know, I think that's really important to me, and it's important to them as well.
We've sort of spoken about Godzilla and Kong at the start, but we just had the first trailer for Cuckoo and I'm really excited about it. It looks great. What was that like to be a part of? And can you talk a little bit about your character there?
Yeah, so very, very different kind of film. Fantastic, yeah. German filmmaker, Tilman Singer, who did this amazing film, Loose, a few years ago that I was so impressed by, and such an inventive, playful filmmaker that's got a bit of kind of David Cronenberg, David Lynch kind of feel to it. And also to get to work with Hunter Schafer, who I was really intrigued by and was absolutely brilliant in this. And yeah, it's a very different kind of horror in a way. It's sort of, it doesn't immediately sort of reveal what's happening. You know, it's a bit more of that of like, you know, this sort of what is going on. And we sort of follow Hunter's character as she sort of, you know, unearths what's going on here. Another very, very fun villain. Yeah, a lovely group there. And yeah, I've got to see it with an audience in South by a couple of weeks ago, and just such a great one to see with a crowd. You know, it's just, I'm really pleased with how that one has come out. Actually, it's really great.
So that was Dan Stevens talking about Abigail. Jamie, what else would you say to listeners to sort of set up this film for them?
It's just a group of criminals. None of them know each other. They've all been hired to do this job, kidnap this little girl and take her off to a safe house for 24 hours. And then they're going to ransom her for 50 million. And they don't know anything about the job. They don't at that point know whose daughter she is, you know, anything. They don't know each other at all. So during the course of a film, you have the usual things that you begin to get to know the characters, like backstories begin to leak out and what they're all doing in this house. You know, is it by chance that they've all been hired, or is there something that kind of ties them all together? So it's all of that. But also, like you hinted, it's one of those movies that sets up as one thing, as one genre, and then completely takes a left turn quite early in the film, probably about 20 minutes, half an hour in, and find out that this little girl is in fact a vampire. It's kind of a loose riff on Dracula's Daughter, the 1930s movie, which was one of the sequels to Dracula. But very, very loose. It's very, very different. And she's little vampire who likes, as she says in the trailer, I believe she likes to play with her food. So all of the people there are going to have to try and defend themselves and get through the night for 24 hours without being eaten by this girl. The house is in complete lockdown. There's no exit from it. The location itself is really good. It's sort of like this big rambling house, you know, with different architecture. It's quite gothic in places. It really looks like the kind of house that they maybe would have had occult rituals in, you know, if you were watching an old Hammer film or something. In terms of the film itself, I think it's good in that it's entertaining. It's funny. It's very, very gory in a fun kind of way. That kind of blood and gore that makes you shriek and drop your popcorn in a kind of fun way rather than a torture porn gross out way. But it's not maybe quite as clever as I was hoping. That you've got a vampire movie, you're playing with a vampire lore, you've got stakes, you've got holy water, you've got garlic, you've got bats, you've got all the vampire lore. And given Radio Silence, how clever they are, you know, they did Ready or Not, they did Scream 5 and Scream 6. I was hoping they'd have a bit more fun and a bit more irreverence and come up with something a bit more original within the kind of myth of the vampires. And I don't think they do. And I also didn't find it scary, which I would say of all of their movies, that I really, really enjoy their films. And they make very fast, slick, entertaining set pieces. But even in the Scream films, I don't think they're particularly scary set pieces. Mm. You know, you compare them to the set pieces of Wes Craven in the first couple of Screams, especially, or A Nightmare on Elm Street. They don't quite have that gift to really, really turn the screws and get the suspense up. So I came away kind of enjoying it. It was good fun. If you went on a Friday night, it's like, for me, a 3-star film, perfectly enjoyable, but I wanted a little bit more.
I felt sort of overall similar to you. Like, obviously, we kind of mentioned this, but for me, I wish I just could have gone in cold, because I felt like when you know that there's this vampire element coming, you know, it's felt like it took a while to get going, considering it is this really kind of lockdown and sort of contained film. It took a while to get going for me, knowing where it wasn't. And they're kind of like, kind of treating it like it is a twist or something to be surprised about, you know, oh, what's going on? When if you've seen any of the trailers, you just know, basically. It wasn't as kind of unpredictable as I might have hoped as well. You know, there were no kind of massive surprises in it for me. But All that said, I actually sort of thought it was fun while it lasted. Like, I really liked Alicia Weir, who's the young girl who plays Abigail, and best known so far for Matilda the Musical, the film. I thought she was great here, like really enjoyed her. And it's just got a good cast overall. I thought the cast were fun, like, because obviously Dan Stevens, who we've already heard from, Melissa Barrera from the recent Scream films is also really good, and is one of the kind of main characters. She's kind of the one who's sort of the moral center, I suppose, of these criminals that are sort of brought there. And then you've also got like Catherine Newton, Kevin Durand, the late Angus Cloud, William Catlett, and Giancarlo Esposito as well. He's always good value when he kind of comes along. He's the one who sort of sets them up in this house in the first place. So it was very easy to watch. And if I just went to see this as like a Friday night, Saturday night film, I'd come away thinking, yeah, that was good fun, enjoyable as a little kind of, you know, horror film, but just not anything more than my expectations, really, and not as kind of great as it could have been. And yeah, like you say, it wasn't particularly scary. There's some fun gore in it, and in a couple of different ways it did remind me a bit of Ready or Not, so that there's definitely elements of that to it. And there are some kind of fun spins on vampire lore as well, but yeah, it didn't kind of totally blow my mind, even though I thought it was, you know, plenty enjoyable, but just not a mind-blowing film.
I do feel very, very sorry for modern day movie makers who always have their twists and turns spoiled by the marketing people, by trailers. I know they have to get viewers in, they have to show the best bits, but as a storyteller, it must be so frustrating to set up a movie. This is like From Dusk Till Dawn. It really is that much of a switch. And you want people, if you went in cold half an hour into his film, you'd go, oh my God, like WTF, it would be an amazing moment. But everyone in that cinema, or most people, are going to know it. And it must just be so frustrating to see that happen.
Yeah, I kind of envy the people who are going to just eventually stumble upon this on TV or streaming service, like in further down the line. Because yeah, like that, I was going to mention From Dusk Till Dawn as well, because that's exactly what I thought of. And I feel like when I saw From Dusk Till Dawn, because I was like fairly young when it came out, my memory is that I was taken by surprise by it, and that I didn't know that it was going to take that sort of hard left turn. But I don't know if I've just kind of told myself that in hindsight. Maybe I did just know. Maybe I did just always know it was a kind of vampire movie. But it's very much in that arena, I'd say. Yeah, the kind of, I mean, there's many comparisons you can make, but just these kind of criminals on the run looking for a bit of escape, and then gets all fangy and bloodthirsty.
The best thing about this film for me is exploding vampires. But basically, in John Carpenter's Vampires back in the late 90s, which isn't one of John Carpenter's best films by any stretch of the imagination, but I really loved that every time a vampire was kind of dragged into the sunlight, that they burst explosively into flame, and it was just a really cool effect. And this one takes it further, and it's just really funny and really gory and violent, just the kind of a way they react to sunlight. It's fantastic.
There's definitely some fun gore here for sure. So if you fancy that is Abigail, and that is in cinemas from now. And next up, we're returning to the world of Velt with this.
You cannot win.
You're all here. Because there is nothing to return to. Dark days lie ahead of us all. We will teach you how to fight. That's impressive.
Okay, so that was Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver, the sequel to Zack Snyder's epic sci-fi two-parter, which kind of kicked off last year. So the second part is almost upon us. But before we review this film, our online entertainment writer Molly Edwards recently sat down with Zack Snyder to talk about the film, and here's what they had to say.
When I spoke to Ed for Part 1, he said that you wanted Part 2 to feel like Dunkirk. So I was wondering, like, how did you apply that particular inspiration to this movie?
I'm a huge fan of Dunkirk, but I feel like when he said Dunkirk, he meant in the sense of a war film, maybe more than specifically the movie Dunkirk. But because, you know, in the end, it really is a it's an assault film, you know, like the Imperium forces are going to annihilate our villagers and they have to figure out how to defend themselves and other things. I won't spoil 100%. But yeah, I think that's what all of our inspiration was, because in the course of making this movie, we kind of made maybe three or four different movies. Like we made like a Western, we made a road picture, a Gather the Soldiers movie. We made like an agricultural film. It feels like when we were harvesting the wheat. And then we made like a full-blown war movie at the end that is just pretty intense.
Without getting into spoilers, there's kind of like the movie ends with like this big tease that there's maybe like more of this story left to tell. Maybe sure. There's more still to come. So I was wondering, can you tell me a bit about like where you want to take the franchise moving forwards? Like is part three kind of definitely going ahead, or are there kind of different directions you want to go in?
We definitely have a story in mind if we were to go forward. You know, we're sort of waiting to like have the totality of these movies comes out, including the director's cut. I'm probably going to make this other little small movie in the meantime and before we decide what to do with more Rebel Moon movies. But yeah, excited to make more Rebel Moon movies if that was in the offing.
And you mentioned the director's cuts, and we know they're coming soon. Is there something like in those or about those that you're most excited for people to see when they arrive?
Yeah, I think the thing I'm most excited about people seeing when they watch the director's cut is the sort of, rather than it being like an extended or different version of these movies, they're kind of like this alternate universe version of the movie. That's kind of how I describe them. Even though, of course, there's many scenes that are the same, there's so much that's different. Even the points of view are slightly different. And I think that'll be fun for audiences to sort of see this much deeper dive. The two movies together are 6 hours. And I think that that's going to be fun for, you know, fans to take a really to go. And also it's very adult as a difference, you know.
So obviously you've made a lot of like big films across your career. And I was wondering, like, is there something in particular that you've learned from any of them that that you brought with you to Rebel Moon that really helped?
Yeah, I think that the sort of relentless nature of this movie, it was such a difficult and long shoot, although I loved it and it was fun. It was just like a marathon, you know, it's like 150 days is like a long shoot. And the thing I think I brought from the other films was that the ability to stay enthusiastic at every day of that long of a schedule is kind of a thing that it's not that you're faking it. Every day when you show up, you have to be able to just like go crush it. And I think that I learned on the movies previous to this, which were also long schedule movies, that really that's the motor that makes the movie. And if you can maintain that, then you can really, you have the ability to make the movie work over a long period of time.
Definitely. I asked the cast like about working with you, and they all said the same thing, that like your enthusiasm was what they're going to bring forward with them into future projects. Speaking to you mentioned like your smaller films, I did want to ask about, you know, over the past few years, you kind of mentioned a few other projects that you'd like to make or that you have worked on that I am very curious about. So it's like a King Arthur movie, the more like grounded film, Horse Latitudes, and then your Alexander the Great script as well. So yeah. I was wondering, like, are any of those projects that you have plans to move forward with?
I mean, I think all of them are potential. Illusions is also one of those movies. I guess for me, what we do next is really based on, you know, not necessarily, it could be one of those. I don't want to say exactly because it's going to be a bit of a surprise. But it's also like I really wanted to do something that's not like a visual effects extravaganza, you know, just because I'd like to just be do something a little grounded. Horse Latitudes is a perfect example of that. It's much more sort of just like a movie we could go film. I know that sounds like, isn't that every movie? But, you know, like a movie like this, like there's nothing to film unless it's, you know, you build it. So it'd be nice to not have to do that.
You've also spoken a few times over the years about the Sucker Punch director's cut. Mm-hmm. So I love that movie. That's one of my favorites of yours. And I was wondering, could you tell me a bit about like why you want to get the director's cut out there so much?
The compromises we made on the PG-13 version of that movie and just really mashing it down to its like, you know, the lowest common denominator, not to be rude. Yeah, I think that the movie suffers from not having the sort of full exploration. It really is a critique, it was at the time for me, of sort of just genre, the genre experience, because I was kind of new to genre. Like, you know, I didn't know. I had only done, like I had done Dawn of the Dead, 300, Watchmen, and Sucker Punch was like the weirdo movie that sort of my experience with fandom and sort of found myself in the heart of genre. I didn't set out to be a genre filmmaker, it just happened. And so my analysis of genre was like what Sucker Punch kind of became. And I thought that no one really got that when I released the movie. I think I've carried throughout my career now is this shocking to me on how sort of misunderstood the movie was. I thought it was super obvious, but I guess it wasn't. But of course, in the actual, like, what I envisioned originally for the film, it was much more on the nose about, it was really super deconstructivist of, like, genre. And so, yeah, I'd love to get at that and give everyone a little bit more of that we filmed. It just never made it in the movie.
And, you know, your Netflix franchises have been, like, both of them, Army of the Dead and Rebel Moon, have been, like, these all original stories. And, you know, and, like, so is Sucker Punch. So I was wondering, like, in your experience, what's been kind of the biggest difference between working on those franchises, like your DC work, and working on, like, your own sort of original ideas? Like, how has that been a different or new thing?
I mean, I guess it's just, like, you would imagine the differences, like, with your own stories or your own IP, you have 100% authority on what works and what doesn't, what's within canon and what's not. But when you do a big IP like Superman or Batman or whatever, you're really sort of wading into this kind of canon that you didn't create. And so the rules around it become a lot stricter. And so you have to sort of deal with that. So yeah, that's the biggest sort of difference. But you know, I'm such a fan of the characters that the canon actually, to me, is attractive. I mean, I tend to want to fight it, but I still respect it.
And I mean, like, because, you know, originally there's a lot of people been talking about, you know, this is a Star Wars film. So I suppose, like, was that kind of attractive to make it original, to get away from the canon?
Yeah, because, of course, it was original before it was a Star Wars film. And then, you know, it was briefly, I talked about it as a Star Wars film with them. And then in taking it back, I was just like, okay, well, let me get back to its modern why of it for me. And so, yeah, it allowed me again to, like, exist outside of what would be a pretty strict canon.
And I want to talk about Cora, because I think she is such an interesting character to be following as, like, a sort of protagonist hero figure in the movie, because she's such a flawed hero figure. Like, we find out about her really sort of tragic, dark past in this film. And I was wondering, like, why did you want to focus the franchise on this character with her really complex past? Is like what you're talking about, like the deconstructing?
Yeah, 100%. I wanted really to challenge the sort of notion of hero in the movie. You know, like, what is it? Like, why? And sort of end of redemption, you know, because I think it's really redemptive. And sort of catharsis is really the theme of the whole thing. You know, like, all of the characters in the movie are really working on some sort of second chance. They're all kind of having to reevaluate their sort of original programming. And I think that that's what the movie in the end is about, you know, is are you locked in, you know, because you can break your own mold and kind of make your way.
And what would you say were kind of, like, the biggest differences between making part one and part two? Because, you know, like you said, part one was, like, the road movie, the gathering the team, and part two was, like, the huge action. So, like, what kind of different challenges did you face?
I mean, the one thing is, like, I wrote them as a single story, right? So that's the one thing I think to keep in mind is that, for me, in a lot of ways, to differentiate the movies, it was almost like a construct that we put on the Over the Giant movie. So in shooting it, it really was about the single story. So I'd know where everyone was and where they came from, you know, it was simpler than to try and be like, okay, we're on movie two, you know, like, I didn't think of it. But I did say, oh, we're back from collecting the team. We need to harvest the crops before the Moa's army gets here to kill everybody. You know, you can keep it in those terms really clearly so everyone understands where they are. The difference between shooting the two movies was, to some extent, we did shoot movie one first, just because harvesting and then doing blowing the village up kind of as we do at the end made it so we kind of wanted to do that stuff last because we would be missing parts of the village if we hadn't. And so, yeah, and so it was an interesting process to kind of move in chronology through that. There was an evolution as the actors and the crew and everyone, we were always discovering something new because we were like, okay, now we're going to blow it up. So let's see what happens.
And Molly also spoke to Sophia Boutella and Staz Nair about Rebel Moon Part 2.
Without getting into spoilers, you know, the movie ends with, like, a big tease of, like, maybe there's more to come and the story's not quite finished. So could you maybe say more about, like, what the future might hold for you both?
I mean, look, I mean, Zach has a lore for this project that extends something like 800, 900, 1,000 years, right? I think it's like, I don't know how many hundreds of years back and how many hundreds of years forward. So, yeah, I think when you've spent 30 years creating a project and worlds like this, the scope is endless, you know. So obviously I think we're quietly hopeful and looking forward to seeing what happens.
Well, we have to find someone and do something and then go somewhere.
That was
right?
So good. That was so cryptic, but I wanted to know more. That was great.
And, you know, on the subject of more, we also know there's the director's cuts coming soon. Is that like a scene or something about those that you're really excited for people to see?
I think what really drew me to the project, other than getting to work with Zack Snyder and all these awesome people, other than the obvious, the director's cut specifically is kind of a lot more gritty and a lot more scuzzy. And I say this a lot in interviews, and it's only because I mean it. Like, if we were living in a dystopian future where there was one planet so a kind of autonomously dictating how and where people eat and, you know, surviving at the cost of one kind of superpower, you know, people would be horrible. You know, people don't get held accountable for what they do in their own countries. You know, if you could do something and then go off world and have no one reprimand you for it, the world would be dirty. It would be dangerous. It would be scary and quite dark. And I think, you know, a lot of the time when we do these beautiful dystopian science fiction stories, we lose some of the realism for the sake of charm. And these kind of worlds, they wouldn't be charming. They would be difficult. And I think the director's cut gives more of that kind of scuzzy realism.
Yeah, it's also like it feels like a different film in a way. And it starts, I saw just the first one, the extended version of the first one. It starts with completely different scenes. And there are like a lot of Easter eggs. A lot of what you see or hear in movie one, you understand the full scope of it in the extended. It's like, oh, that's what happened. Like, there are a lot of Easter eggs. Actually, it's actually pretty fun.
Yeah, to my knowledge, Zack said he wants them to be roughly around 3 hours each. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of getting an hour on each movie.
There are certain scenes that I think I forgot about.
Yeah.
You know, because we started filming 2 years ago. And we shot for 10 months. We did so much within that time. And I feel like when I saw the PG-13 of movie one and two, I was like, what about that moment? And that moment was like, oh, you know it's going to be in the extended version. And yeah, it's exciting.
Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver. You haven't seen this at this point, have you, Jamie?
No, they didn't do any press screening. So it was just the premiere last night, which I believe you went to.
So I wasn't the premiere.
To that. So is it any good? I mean, the first one left me a little bit cold, I have to admit.
Yeah, the first one left a lot of people cold, and I saw it on the very big screen. I saw it on IMAX, and it got a very limited cinema release, that one, whereas this one is not getting a cinema release. This one is just going straight to Netflix. And I don't know if it was just a big screen experience or something, but I actually didn't mind the first one. Like, I know it got quite harsh reviews. I just about would make it into the 3-star bracket with that. I sort of enjoyed the sort of world building and the scale. And got along fine with it, if, you know, wasn't completely blown away. That was sort of a lot of setup. And it's one of those things like with quite a lot of sci-fi, where if you go into all the sort of terminology and lingo and all that, it can get quite complicated. But like on the most simple level, it is basically like that sort of Seven Samurai type story, where there's this kind of band of warriors defending a sort of outpost against this all-powerful enemy. And it's obviously massively inspired by Star Wars. So there's that kind of element to it, to these kind of sci-fi farm folk and the Imperium, which are sort of, you know, have more than a bit of a shade of Star Wars empire about them. And basically, you need to have seen the first one ahead of this, because you're seeing how the gang kind of come together and sort of getting to know them a little bit. And then it's one of those situations where Zack Snyder has described it as basically he just wrote this massive epic as one big story. And then there's the question of, do we really cut it down, or do we just sort of instead just cut it in half and just sort of split it in two and just tell this one big story in two big parts? And Netflix were very up for that. Obviously, it kind of works well over their sort of streaming services, I guess, to have it in this way. And they're in a position, I suppose, where they can just go all in on that kind of thing. That's what they did, basically. They kind of cut it in half, and this is very much the second half. So how I found this one was, it's just all battle, really. The vast majority of it is just battle. Like, we have Ed Skrein's noble kind of returns. We kind of saw that at the end of the last one. He kind of returns from the brink of death, and he's back to kind of, you know, seek vengeance and kind of take everything from this farm world of Velt. We've got Sophia Boutella's Cora, who's leading the, you know, these people to defend themselves, getting weapons ready. I quite enjoyed that. I always enjoy like a sort of training montage. There was, you know, probably my favorite sequence of the film, where they're all kind of getting ready for, they've got a couple of days to prepare for this invasion. So they getting all the weapons they can, training everyone up. getting all their techniques down. Yeah, then basically the Imperium sort of arrive, and it's just a massive battle from there then on, which sort of has its moments. Obviously, Snyder is a good sort of visual stylist, so there's a lot of kind of, you know, his trademark slow-mo kind of action, a lot of explosions. But I must admit, I didn't like this film as much as the first one, because I found there was no real development or sort of arc to any of the characters, really. It was just all battle, and you sort of hoped for some of the characters to be developed a bit further, which they sort of weren't really. To be honest, it made it feel a bit one note. Like in the first one, you get this sort of, that, you know, where they're assembling this crew, we're sort of jumping around a lot, and here we're just in this one location. And I appreciated about this and the last one is that they obviously kind of filmed on real locations that they famously grew all this kind of corn for it. But like, one, there's still a hell of a lot of, you know, kind of CGI backgrounds, and two, it just feels quite small still. It feels like this place where they live just felt quite small. You didn't get that impression of a vast world kind of, you know, existing beyond this, and, you know, didn't get the impression of anyone else kind of living on this moon or any other sort of communities there. It just feels like this one small kind of area. Yeah, so for that reason, I found it a bit of a disappointment and a bit underwhelming. And as you probably know, Jamie, like the kind of plan for these is that they're going to be releasing director's cuts on Netflix as well, sort of a bit further down the line. Each part so far is about 2 hours each, but they're going to be adding like pretty much an hour to each one. So you're going to get a good sort of 6 hours worth of Rebel Moon. And they're apparently going to be much more sort of adult in terms of violence and things like that. And so, like, you know, very much kind of pushing the R-rated side of things. So part of me thinks that once those come along, you'll get things filled out a bit more, and some of the characters might make a bit more sense. There might be a bit more of an arc to it, a bit more shape there. But as it was, I didn't really find it very satisfying. And I was kind of surprised as well that, you obviously, there's always, like, you know, these films always hint at a bigger world and, you know, more to potentially come. But I was surprised quite how powerfully this one hinted at more to come, basically. So again, you kind of come away from it feeling like, okay, they haven't quite finished this story. But will we get further films? I mean, I guess it's going to depend how well these do. Yeah, that was another thing which sort of left a bit of a sort of sour taste for me, that I would just rather this one was told satisfyingly. And then if they decide to pick it up again, you know, you always can with this kind of sci-fi world. There's always going to be more corners to explore and go into the mythology a bit more. But yeah, it underwhelmed me in a few ways, I must say, despite being so kind of bombastic.
I'm not sure how I feel about these endless kind of director's cuts that are happening now with streaming. You know, it's very easy with streaming to release a different version. You know, there's going to be the 4 hour 10 minute version of Napoleon, and you've just said with Zack Snyder the longer ones. In a way, I'm kind of all for it, because I want to see the director's true vision, and sometimes it can improve and deepen a film. Like, talking of Ridley Scott, like Kingdom of Heaven, the director's cut is so much better. And the theatrical cut, I think, you know, The Two Towers, for example, with Peter Jackson, I think the director's cut is far superior to the theatrical cut. It just has more depth of character. But then another part of me thinks, you know, are we getting to the point where it's just happening with every big film, and there's going to be two or three versions of everything, and what is the definitive version? And, you know, it could get all a bit messy and out of hand, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think with this as well, to be honest, I would have rather just leapt straight in and just seen the sort of definitive vision that he kind of wanted to set out. Like, you're investing a lot of time in these anyway, because I mean, if you're watching both, you're investing a good 4 hours, so you might as well go all in and invest your kind of 6 hours or so when that's ready. And there were a couple of moments in this and the previous film where it almost feels like that they have kind of censored the violence, where, you know, you're not kind of seeing things as kind of full on as you might expect, and kind of get the impression they're sort of holding that back for when this R-rated cut comes. So I'd just rather just see the full one. It does feel a bit odd to have done it this way. But I mean, so they say that it's very different. Apparently it's going to feel very different, the other one. So maybe it'll feel different enough, but obviously you've already seen these films, so is there more of an effort to I thought, right, come on, are you really going to invest again the 6 hours? But sure,
yeah,
many people will. But
I can't say I particularly want to. I will, because I'm a completist and I'll put myself through it. But, you know, I'll watch this version that's when it comes out on Netflix. I'll watch it. I watched the first one, and even though I didn't particularly like it, I will watch this one. But I can't say I'm hankering to then see the 3 hour versions. I'm also not really sure we need another Seven Samurai, you know, adaptation.
I mean, yeah.
We've had it so many times. We had The Magnificent Seven. We had A Bug's Life. And, you know, you may think, oh, well, they're doing it in space, that's different. But we had Battle Beyond the Stars, which is a bit more of a B-movie produced by Roger Corman in 1980. But that, again, was kind of Seven Samurai in space. So it's like, how many times can you do it?
I don't mind these tropes sort of being revisited, but as long as they're kind of done well, really, I suppose. But this, hasn't really quite lived up to its promise, I don't think.
Well, I can't say you've sold it to me, Matt. I'm not desperate to see it.
Apologies. But if you do actually want to check that out, that is Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver, and that is on Netflix now. And next up, we've got like a comedy of biblical proportions with this.
I'm Clarence.
Where I'm from, you fight to survive. I'm not a bad person, just playing the cards I was dealt. Mom, one day I'm gonna get you out of here. I have a plan.
What are we doing here?
Jesus lives there. Hallelujah, baby.
Hallelujah. I want to be like that in 10 years.
I want to be like that now.
I need to figure out what inspires him.
I can just replicate what he does. Imagine the money people will give us. Hallelujah. Holy shit, I get highest
Buddha. Put you on that highway. So that was The Book of Clarence. Jamie, do you want to briefly set this one up for us?
So this is kind of along the lines of something like Life of Brian. It's a biblical satire set in the time of Jesus. It's written and directed by James Samuel, who's the musician. He also does the music on this, who, of course, made his directorial debut a couple of years ago with the revisionist Western, The Heart of a Fool, which I quite enjoyed. You know, it was quite stylish and fun. And this one is about Clarence, which is no surprise given the title, played by Lakeith Stanfield, who is always quite a kind of commanding, mesmerizing actor, I find. And he plays Clarence, who wants to become the 13th apostle, but he's kind of laughed out of town. He's a weed dealer and he's got debts and, you know, and he's not really suitable for the life. So he's laughed out of town. So he comes up with the idea that he will become a rival messiah. So he would fake miracles and he would go around doing his fake miracles and he'd learn to orate from mountaintops and sort of gain followers. And that way he plans to make loads of money, pay back his debts and, you know, be quids in, literally. Lakeith Stanfield also plays Thomas, who's one of the 12 apostles. So he's in dual roles. Their brothers, Thomas and Clarence. Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag for me, but it doesn't really know what it wants to be. That on the one hand, you know, it's a biblical satire that can be quite irreverent, it can be quite blasphemous in places, it can be quite funny. And then on the other hand, it really sort of soft pedals everything, and Clarence grows a conscience, it becomes quite reverent about religion, it doesn't really want to offend anybody at the end. And often you have scenes, you know, it goes from one thing to the other, like the crucifixion scene is played quite straight.
Yeah.
But then you've got Jesus Christ on the cross, and there's a cameo there playing Jesus. I won't say who in case you don't know, but just the person they've got as the cameo is quite kind of amusing. And then what Jesus says when he's on the cross is really, really, you know, if you're religious, it's really quite blasphemous the way he speaks on the cross. So you think, oh, that's going to offend everyone. And then the next minute, you know, it's being really sort of, you know, pro-religion and being really kind of not wanting to offend again. So it really does kind of want its cake and eat it. So I found it a bit of a mixed bag, to be honest. And yeah, it wasn't really for me.
Yeah, I must say you've kind of very much summed up my thoughts there in a lot of ways, in that I was very intrigued by this film because it's got like a really interesting cast. You know, obviously, as you said, it can't help but bring to mind Life of Brian, you know. So it's obviously sort of ripe for potential comedy. And there were kind of moments in it I liked. I sort of liked the relationship that Clarence has with his friend Elijah, played by RJ Seiler, who was also in The Harder They Fall. And there's sort of there's some kind of funny moments in it, and like just the one bit that actually just did really make me laugh was the kind of talk about the Immaculate Conception with Mary and Joseph, and it's obviously low hanging fruit, but I did think it was funny. But then I just kind of entirely agree that I just felt like it needed to go harder, like one way or the other. Like it either needed to be a bit more kind of raucous in its comedy and a bit more outrageous, or it needed to have been a more kind of serious kind of take on the material and these kind of elements that it's playing with, and the sort of elements of, like, you know, sort of whitewashing history that kind of come into it as well. I just never really, for that reason, I never felt kind of truly, truly invested. And yeah, I did always just feel a bit torn as to what they wanted it to be, whether they were kind of, you know, thinking of it as a full on comedy. And then, like you say, when it then turns quite serious, when you get to the kind of crucifixion element, I just didn't really know where I stood, and I kind of struggled with it. And it kind of, in a way, made sense to me that what was strange about the release of this film was kind of premiered at the London Film Festival last year. And then it was kind of due to be released over here, I think at a similar sort of time to when it came out in the US, sort of earlier in the year. But then it just suddenly got postponed out of nowhere. And then it's kind of now sort of arriving with a bit of a whimper, really, over here. So I'm sort of not really surprised, because again, you just kind of get the impression that maybe just no one really quite knows what to make of it. And which is a shame, because there's some interesting things going on. It sort of looks nice, doesn't it? I thought they kind of created that world pretty well. Some, you know, some good actors and performances in there, but just didn't all come together for me.
Yeah, there's some good cameos. Like, I won't give away the Jesus cameo, but there's David Oyelowo plays John the Baptist. James McAvoy is Pontius Pilate. So, you know, there's some big names and big faces in there. I wasn't so sure about how it looked, but this is one of my pet peeves with modern films, that often they're so pin sharp, high definition, that they can look almost a bit cartoonish to me. And I felt with a film like this, because it's set 2000 years ago, you really want that feel of the mud and the dirt and the dust, you know, in Judea. And for me, it just felt a little bit too pristine in the look of it. You know, I much prefer something like Life of Brian, where it just feels like they went out there and built the sets and kind of really toiled through the dust. So I wasn't sure with that. One thing I did like, and this is me being puerile, but I always like this in films, is when you have kind of anachronistic dialogue. Like, there's one bit where Clarence, I think it is, performs a miracle, because quite bizarrely towards the end of the film, he can suddenly do genuine miracles, it seems, which is a really weird thing. But like, he does a miracle and one of the on-watchers sort of says, oh, you know, which is this reaction to the miracle. And there's another bit where someone says, oh, it's going to require massive testicular fortitude. Nice,
yeah.
You know, and there's loads of funny bits like that. They always make me titter, because I am a big child at heart. But yeah, for me, it was just kind of seesawed wildly. So came out the other side thinking that could have been something really special if they'd had the courage of their convictions and gone with it. But it's almost like they bottled it.
So yeah, I kind of largely agree really there. But if you do fancy checking that out, that is The Book of Clarence, which is in cinemas now. And a real change of pace now for our final film of the week.
How you doing, Fran?
Not bad.
I'd love to introduce you all to the newest member of our little family. This is Robert.
Hello. Hey. Fran, right?
Hey, Fran. Sorry.
I scared you. I'm sneaking up on people. Booga booga.
Remember the...
What do you call a sad coffee? That espresso.
You're funny.
Do you have plans tonight?
So did you like the movie?
I didn't really like anything about the movie.
What do you like?
My job.
What about it?
I'm good at it.
Tell me something about you.
Got divorced. I guess I can't seem to figure it out.
Figure one out?
Love.
So that was Sometimes I Think About Dying, which is a sort of somewhat quirky dramedy, which premiered at Sundance, sort of no surprises there. And notably, it stars Daisy Ridley, and she plays Fran, who is this kind of sort of introverted, somewhat awkward office worker who, as the sort of title hints at, she has these quite sort of vividly realized daydreams in which she's dying. there's not really a huge amount to say about the plot because it's very, very low key. And a lot of it is about the kind of the texture of this world in this kind of anonymous office environment. It's that kind of almost parody of an office, you know, that you kind of expect from these sort of things. And basically she's living this really sort of really muted existence, and it doesn't really get involved with her kind of overly chirpy colleagues and their sort of, you know, games and that kind of thing. And then into the mix comes this guy called Robert, played by Dave Mahergy. And that then the film is a kind of, you know, bit about their sort of relationship and him kind of bringing her out of her shell a little bit, I suppose, and sort of getting to know her. Yeah, so that's the basic premise. And it is a really, really sort of stripped back, bare kind of premise. There's not a great deal to it. I sort of learned afterwards, one of those things where you learn this and then you think, oh yeah, that makes sense. But it's kind of, there was previously a short film that this is kind of loosely based on. It's also based on a 2013 play called Killers. You kind of get, it is that thing where you kind of get that vibe that maybe it is a premise stretched a bit thin over this amount of time. But all that said, I actually sort of still found things to enjoy in it. Like particularly, I actually really liked Daisy Ridley's performance in it. I really sort of bought her as this, you know, introverted and very much in her own head. I thought she played it really nicely, actually, without kind of overdoing it in a way that would be sort of really possible with this kind of subject matter. And I just sort of really believed her, and I thought it kind of showed some acting chops. I feel like I haven't necessarily seen with her, and obviously with the Star Wars films it's a completely different type of acting and performance. So yeah, so I thought she brought something nice to it. But but at the same time, it's a film that I wouldn't rush to recommend because it is just so slight. But I kind of enjoyed the texture of the world it created, and you know, I kind of enjoyed getting to know that character. Maybe as well, yeah, like once you start to get into the second half, it felt a bit stretched, a bit thin again, maybe thinking that was a premise just pushed a bit too far. But I enjoyed spending time with these characters, and I did enjoy Robert as well. He had that just very likable kind of quality of like when someone kind of does come into a workplace and just enlivens it a bit, and you just kind of want to be friends with them and want to get to know them, and the kind of person you can just imagine drawing someone out of their shell a bit. Yeah, so like low key, I kind of enjoyed it, but yeah, it's not one to really write home about. Did you like it, Jamie?
I'm kind of the same that Daisy Ridley, I thought, was good in it. It's very hard to come out of a big franchise and then kind of find your feet and prove you can do other stuff. She did Marsh King's Daughter, was it earlier this year or end of last year, which I thought she was quite good in. And this, again, she really kind of underplays it. She's almost like a kind of ghost going through this world where she's so disconnected from everyone. And she just sort of watches other people in the office as they kind of talk and banter. And they seem to be getting genuine enjoyment out of their days. And she just doesn't, you know, she just sort of drifts through it. I think it caught that sense of depression and disconnection very well. There's a wonderful scene where she is handed a leaving card to sign, and like she kind of reads all the other messages, and they're all so kind of ebullient, and everyone's, you know, come out of these great leaving messages, and she's just sort of there with a pen poised in her hand, kind of thinking, what the hell can I write, you know, because she can't summon the energy or the exuberance to do it. So I think it was good in that way. The trouble with it is, this is good in a way that the director, Rachel Lambert, she doesn't go for a big sort of heart-swelling finale, and she doesn't have Fran really come out her shell and discover herself and become a really happy, chirpy person. You know, it sort of just goes along at its own pace and things stay pretty much the same. The changes are very, very gradual and very small. But as a viewer, that makes it quite hard to really connect with the film. That when you make a film about someone who's that disconnected and that depressed, it's hard to make a film that doesn't make the viewer feel a little bit disconnected and depressed. So I kind of admired it in a way, but I didn't really particularly enjoy it to the point I would recommend it. It's quite a hard one to explain.
Yeah, what you've said, I would say that it's, in many ways, it is a film that has those elements you admire. Like you feel like Rachel Lambert, who's kind of directed it, you feel like she's got a kind of a clear sort of voice. And I thought the kind of imaginary scenes were sort of well staged, like you said, like that card being a particular moment. But there was a few times where it just zoomed in on little details which sort of illuminated that world, which I just thought were kind of nicely handled. And like I mentioned, Daisy Ridley's performance. But then there's those elements that you admire, but perhaps that it doesn't really sort of sweep you along in a sort of satisfying story element kind of way. So it's almost like, feels like a calling card for both Rachel Lambert and Daisy Ridley, which kind of shows what they could perhaps do with a story that's a bit more engaging and a bit more easy to invest in.
Yeah, it definitely felt a little bit drawn out, the short story element, the fact it came from a short, it did feel stretched without a doubt. I was going with it, and then kind of the more it went on, the more it lost me in a way.
But if you do fancy giving that a try, that's Sometimes I Think About Dying, which is also in cinemas now. We're approaching the end now, Jamie. Like, what's your film of the week this week?
That's a tricky one, because we haven't like raved about anything, have we? I'm sorry to listeners that we haven't slated everything, but it's been quite a sort of low key, like, yeah, that's three stars, that's a bit May, that's a bit. But if I had to pick one, I would probably go for Abigail, just in terms of if you're looking to go to a cinema this weekend and you just want a fun time, I'd probably say Abigail.
I agree that Abigail was the film I sort of most out and out enjoyed out of this selection this week. Even though, despite having those reservations, I still found it a very enjoyable time. So that would be my pick of the week. Don't forget to check out the current issue of Total Film with the Fall Guy. And if you're thinking of subscribing, Magazines Direct are running a spring sale, which you can get 3 issues of Total Film for just £5. So like £5 in total for 3 issues. So that's kind of unbeatable price, really. And
madness.
You can find a link to that offer in the show notes of this podcast. And also, if you fancy subscribing to the podcast, we'd love it if you could do that on your app of choice. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for one quick question. Jamie, this was inspired by the training montage in Rebel Moon Part 2.
Okay.
A big question, but what's your favourite training montage from the movies?
Oh my God. Well, I absolutely love a training montage. I know that they're used liberally, that you can almost get to the point where it's just a complete cliche, but I always enjoy a training montage. But if I had to go for one, then the kind of 14-year-old boy I was would absolutely demand I choose Rocky IV, which is a film I adored and watched on loop as a teenager. And that training montage, when you're kind of cutting between Stallone, Rocky Balboa, doing it the kind of old-fashioned way, running up mountains and like heaving himself up with press-ups, you know, and sit-ups from beams of wood and dragging machinery and all that kind of thing. And it cuts from that to the Ivan Drago, you know, state of the art with everything, like, you know, all the pads on his chest and all the tubes and everything monitored and, you know, state-of-the-art electric equipment, running treadmills, gym equipment. And it sort of cuts between them and they're both like getting into the absolute peak condition to go up in the ring against each other. I just found it incredibly exciting and still do. I still go back to that movie every now and then and I absolutely adore it. So I would go Rocky IV.
Yes, I think you have picked the absolute best one there. And obviously you just always think of like the Rocky movies in general, don't you, for training montages. And like, I love the training montage in 3 where he's kind of training with Apollo Creed as well, and they're sort of running down the beach. I think the Creed films as well have had great training montages. And actually, Creed 2 is my sort of default least favourite of the Creed trilogy, but I think that's got the best training montage of the Creed films, where they're training out in the desert and like Michael B. Jordan's using this massive sledgehammer and he's doing those kind of exercises where he's kind of getting walloped in the abs while he's doing these kind of pull-ups. And I thought that one really, really went all out with the training montage. But if we rule out sort of repeating the Rocky and Creed franchise, I'm going to go for Team America World Police, because I just love that montage. And it's got the amazing song montage that goes with it as well. I haven't seen that film for years, but just still lines from that montage song stick with me. And that's the song that really stuck with me from that film. So yeah, I'm going to go for that. And I've got a soft spot for the training montage in the animated Mulan as well. And I really like the song that goes with that, the I'll Make a Man Out of You song. So that's another one I'll give a shout out to as a different kind of montage. But always enjoy that.
I think we should start doing Rocky-type montages in the Total Film Office. I would love to see you hanging from a beam by your ankles while Jordan pummels your abdomen. I would really enjoy seeing that.
Maybe after we've gone to press on the next issue. But that's all we've got time for now anyway. Thanks very much for joining us again. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.